Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of December. Healthcare reform is what we talk about this first hour on our program. As you know, the president-elect has chosen former Senator Tom Daschle, the former Senate Majority Leader, to head Health and Human Services, and he will also head a new White House office on health reform. For how many years now have we talked about health reform in this country, and little has happened on this front? The new Secretary of Health and Human Services envisions a new federal agency, a federal health board, with the authority to set guidelines for what treatments and procedures are most cost-effective. He supports a mandate to get all Americans to get health insurance and creation of a public insurance program to cover people who don't get private insurance. We're going to be talking about other plans and the overall vision that the president-elect has of affordable, accessible health care for every single American. We have two guests with us for the first half hour, and one guest will continue through the whole hour. Our guests are Noam Levy, who is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau and wrote a very interesting piece on this just recently this week. And we thank you very much, Noam, for joining us for our program. Good morning to you. Jonathan Weiner is also with us, a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Professor Weiner, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleased to be here.
So when I just outlined briefly Tom Daschle's plans for health reform, are those, can we add to that, or is that his overarching theme of where he would like to go with health care? Noam, you want to start?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to distinguish between his ideas for what kind of a system he would craft and what may end up being the Obama administration's proposal. They could very well be two different things. But generally speaking, what Senator Daschle has advocated is the creation of a new mechanism for ensuring the some 46 million people in America that don't have health insurance. Most people in America get their health insurance through their employers still. The rest are covered in a government program, either Medicare, Medicaid. There's children's health insurance, the VA system. So what Senator Daschle has proposed, generally speaking, is creating a new public-private system on top of what we have right now to do that. And part of that is, as you mentioned, the creation of a new federal agency that would help create this new market for insuring some 46 million uninsured Americans and as you said, set some guidelines for what would be covered by those who get public insurance.
And how would this be funded, this new program?
Well, that's the big question. You know, at this point, what President-elect Obama has talked about is that savings that are generated by a more efficient system could help generate some of the revenue for this. And he talked on the campaign trail as well as using money from rolling back some of the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans to pay for it. The latter seems less and less likely, as President-elect Obama has indicated that he may not want to pass along a tax hike even for the wealthiest Americans. So there are going to be some big questions about how to pay for it.
Professor Weiner, do you see a difference between what the president-elect has talked about in the campaign trail as to what he would craft for health care reform and what Daschle would craft?
Well, there are some differences, and we'll get back to the main focus of this show, the so-called health care board, or some have called it a health care Fed. That is a difference that wasn't talked about in quite the same way, but they are on the same page. And again, as you pointed out, we've been discussing this for 50 years now, mm-hmm. and Senator Daschle and then Senator Obama were on the same page. In fact, Daschle was key as an advisor to Obama, although they did have some differences. As appropriate, we can point them out. It's also very important, as it's been discussed already, is just because somebody wants to put these very significant reforms in place, that doesn't mean it'll happen, both because of the legislative process and, of course, the severe financial process.
Right.
But I think it's worth, during this show, and it's a very important topic because there's a few issues more important than health care, mm-hmm. to really identify some of the themes. And, if it were a show 2 or 3 months ago, we would have talked about some of the differences between McCain and Obama. That's somewhat moot. Mm-hmm. And now to focus on, the key messages Obama has. And obviously he telegraphed some of his intentions by putting former Senator Daschle, as has been called, the health care czar. And I think he's made this one of his two or three key, I used to say, social platforms, but now many people think it's sort of key to the economic platform as well.
Mm-hmm. You talk about 50 years we've been talking about this. How true. I can't tell you how many talk shows we've done in this year after year, administration after administration. Why in the world is it so hard for us to insure those people, growing number, huge number, who are uninsured in this country?
Well, if you'd like me to go first on that, of course, as you say, that's been many shows. We've got to want to do it. We've got to have the gumption, and we've elected a president who has put that at the top of his platform. I think it's difficult. Healthcare is so personal. It's so expensive. I think, as most of your listeners know by now, it's, $2.2 trillion, about $7,000 a person, the most expensive healthcare system in the world, the only developed country in the world that doesn't insure everybody.
Right.
But lest we understand that the savings, and I'm sure Noam and I can discuss that, President-elect Obama's team thinks there may be savings as much as 20 or 30%. Not many other people believe that. But all of that health care is in someone's pocket. So that means, are we going to take it from someone to give it to someone else? I think, yes, perhaps we should, but that's very, very difficult to do. And moreover, you don't have to have a PhD in health economics. For every person we add to the rolls, at least today, we have to come up with $5,000, $6,000, $7,000. Where is that going to come from? So
right.
Those are some of the key ingredients.
Noam, what do you think? Why so long in getting something on the table here?
Well, I think Professor Weiner has made one of the most important points, which is that this has been viewed in the past as a zero-sum game. I mean, if someone gets something, if someone gets insurance, if insurers are required to do something or businesses are required to do something, they have to give up something, whether that be money. They may have to pay more for those of us who do have insurance may end up having to pay more. Businesses may end up having to contribute more of their bottom line in some way. And certainly people who don't have insurance right now, some of whom are healthy and some of whom could afford insurance, will be paying something that they don't have. So anytime you craft a major social reform that affects such a large part of the economy, they're going to be winners and losers. I would add one other thing, which is that the number of players who are involved in the healthcare industry, whether they be insurers, hospitals, doctors, small businesses, large businesses, government agencies, is enormous, and pharmaceutical companies, and each of these interests are well funded. They are full of veterans who have worked the policy and political fronts in Washington for a long time. And these are heavy hitters. These are people who know how to fight when they have to, and they have done it in the past, and I'm sure they'll do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Noam's exactly right, and some say that's the key reason Senator Daschle was put in place. In addition to being a good man, a smart man, he knows how Washington works. And so there's plenty of policy wonks that perhaps know more about health care than he, some of whom are on his team. But this man knows how to make things happen for all the reasons Noam mentioned. I think it's the number one, number two, and number three lobbyists in the U.S. are all health care.
Right. Does the president, just politically speaking, and in order to have some success in changing our health care system, need to get something fashioned right off the bat, get it on the table, and get it through Congress before he gets bogged down in other things, before he may have, maybe he'll be successful at everything, but before he embarks on areas in which he may not be successful, so health care comes too late, then it just gets bogged down in the administration?
Well, certainly, I mean, one of the lessons that Senator Daschle and others take from the debacle of the Clinton plan 15 years ago is that President Clinton waited too long to push his health care proposal. There are many reasons why it failed, and we can discuss those if you'd like, but one of them I think there's broad consensus about is that it took nearly a year for President Clinton to actually get legislation onto Capitol Hill. It was a big bill, more than 1,000 pages. It had been developed largely without the input of some key players, which is another lesson. But perhaps most importantly, one of the problems with waiting that long was that President Clinton had already expended a fair amount of what they like to say in Washington is political capital, fighting to get the NAFTA through. He had a bruising fight with his own party about balancing the federal budget. So by the time he needed to rally the troops for what would have been a major overhaul, he had lost a lot of influence. Secondly, by waiting a year, he was only one year away from the next election, and at that point, Republicans led by Newt Gingrich and some others saw a political imperative in basically stopping anything because they saw the fight against health care as one of the tickets to their securing a congressional majority.
Mm-hmm.
So it does speak to the importance of moving quickly, I think.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Professor Weiner?
Yes, Kathleen, I would. All the points that Noam made. I think in Daschle's book that he wrote while he was sort of on hiatus, what do we do about the healthcare crisis? If I'm not mistaken, he actually had a chapter on what we learned from the Clinton era, and there are a couple things. One is that there must be transparency, and I think they've already started having a town hall meeting. And so this will be much more transparent. And then clearly we've got to work with the industry. And this time, rather than having Harry and Louise, those were the mythical characters that the insurance lobbyists sent against health care reform, guess what? Harry and Louise have come back, and they're supporting health care reform. So I'm at least optimistic that they got that message.
They got a little older, right?
They lost their coverage because the insurance dumped them, and now
yes.
So the insurers really are on board. Everybody's on board, but the devil's in the detail.
Right. You wrote a few years ago, and I'm wondering if you still believe in this, that the country needs an accountable, transparent mechanism that makes use of scientific evidence, ethics, and consumer values to collectively decide what we can and cannot afford to cover as part of a basic insurance package. Let's talk about that a little bit. Is that going to be something the administration will be grappling with?
Yes. And if you look at, most of us policy wonks, you ask us, gee, what is Tom Daschle proposing, it's pretty much all similar to other platforms except this issue. He talks about a federal health care board. I and others have called it a health care fed. Every other country in the world has it. There are many problems in health care, but the biggest is just as you cited some of the stuff that I and others have said, is we can't pay for everything. Some stuff costs $10,000. And maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, maybe it gives you, and this is tough stuff, a couple of extra weeks or months of life. And if it were me, I'd want that, maybe. But on the other hand, we have stuff that costs 50 cents that people can't afford day by day, and they're dying because of it. So we've got to make decisions, give everybody basic health care, things that work, things that add value to life. And then beyond that, we can negotiate, but it isn't automatic.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that is what Daschle's proposing. It's extremely controversial.
Yes, it is.
Most people support it, at least theoretically, but there's a lot. We don't always act theoretically, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wait, what do you think about this part of the discussion, Noam?
Well, I think it is one of the vital and potentially most controversial parts of what will be discussed. One of the most politically explosive words in healthcare debate is rationing, and that's a term that opponents of a stronger federal role in setting guidelines for what should and shouldn't be covered have used to deride that proposal in the past. There have been there's a whole history of political opposition that's founded on comparing proposals to what Canada has or what the UK has with its National Health Service, and it's going to be something that's going to be very, very tough to deal with. Senator Daschle, in his book and others, make the point that the American system as it exists right now already has a form of rationing in the way that individual insurance companies deny coverage,
sure.
In the way that Medicare sets its reimbursement schedules for doctors and hospitals. So the system as it exists right now, in essence, has a form of rationing in it. But once you centralize that and once you actually sort of invest a federal agency with some sort of power over the entire market, you raise the prospect, frightening to some people, that the federal government is going to be coming down with too heavy a hand.
Kathleen, if I can say a
sure.
few more words and put it in, just sort of that any listener can relate to. Right now we are doing rationing. Someone that can't afford health insurance is being rationed, and they're being left out of the system. Right now, insurance companies, some of them are doing a good job, some aren't doing a good job, are deciding what they should or shouldn't pay for behind closed doors. Wouldn't we all rather have transparent, led by doctors, led by ethicists, and having an honest discussion based on evidence? And every other country does this. And so, you know, it will not be easy because, there, you know, we have to say no. You know, after all, their health care is limited. And there's, probably a good proportion of your listeners are having their care rationed right now. This would provide something for everybody and would be rational.
Let's go to our phone calls in a moment here. And we have one line open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. Last week, President-elect Obama named former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. And he will also be head of a new White House office on health reform. We're talking about what he has written and said about health reform and what the President-elect has said about this and what needs to happen and why nothing really. Not nothing, but very few things have happened in this area in some 50 years of conversation. We have two guests with us. Professor Jonathan Weiner is professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Health, and he is a professor of health policy and management. We're also speaking with Noam Levy, who's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau and wrote an interesting piece this week on this very subject. So to you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with Mike from Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. Let me pull over here.
Thank you, Mike.
I'm a retired radiation oncologist, and I've heard this debate for the past, you know, X number of years, and it disgusts me and it nauseates me. The solution is very simple. We need national health care, a system run like Medicare, universal health care, no insurance companies. Let me just give you one example. I have worked in France. I also have good friends in Norway that are radiation oncologists. Norway is roughly the size of Wisconsin with a slightly smaller population. There are 7 institutions in Norway that provide radiation oncology with expensive radiation machines. In the state of Wisconsin, at my last count, there were 37 facilities that provided this care. In fact, in Milwaukee, there are 2 privately owned facilities that are literally right next door to each other on Rawson Avenue. Those facilities don't work 12 hours a day. They work 6 to 8 hours a day, and somebody's paying for that care.
Mm-hmm.
My last comment is, in the United States, we pay $6,500 to $7,000 a year per person for our health care. In Western Europe, it's $3,500. It's real simple. The solution is real simple. Unfortunately, I have no confidence in Barack Obama, in Tom Daschle, in addressing this problem, in having a universal, revolutionary change in health care. It's not going to happen.
Professor Weiner.
Well, he had 2 choices. He had Obama and McCain. So, you know, I don't know what to say about that, although I would agree with Dr. Mike. I'm afraid I don't know your last name. And he's correct. Everything he said is correct. But many of the supporters of the so-called single payer, which is you're not that far from Canada there, and I'm sure you have friends and colleagues up north, it is a superior system to ours, at least as a professor of public health. I believe that. But probably 90% of Mike's colleagues, other physicians, would not agree. So hence the challenge. Most Americans and most American industry is not ready for it, although a sizable percentage believe that is the answer.
Mm-hmm. What about universal health care? Is that a goal for us, do you think, Noam, or simply because of the way we've set up our system, we're nowhere near that, nor will we ever be?
Well, I think, among the things that there is broad consensus about now, I think, is that universal coverage is the goal. As Jonathan said, I don't think single payer is going to be the way that it will happen because just the political obstacles are too great.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the reasons why Senator Daschle and Senator Obama on the campaign trail talked about blending public and private systems. But the one of the driving forces here is that when we're done with the reform process, if it's successful, that, you know, that we will essentially get as close to universal coverage as is possible.
And one other component is that Daschle and Obama are trying to push, you know, our closest thing to a government program that is Medicare and Medicaid, but they're not shutting down the the private sector system,
right,
as perhaps Mike would suggest we do.
Let's go to Roger from Fitchburg next. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Well, I have quite a bit of experience with the health insurance since I'm severely disabled. I think that we're dying because private health insurance exists to the extent that it does. If we exclude the money that government gives to the insurance companies to hand over to patients and all the money that they rip off the top, the private insurance pays only 19% of health costs in the country. So, and I further assert that just getting some kind of insurance for 47 million Americans that are uninsured isn't enough. It should be comprehensive. So what can we do here now to try to move President-elect Obama toward something closer to a national health insurance system?
Well, you know, one thing which Senator Daschle has talked about and which we mentioned earlier was the creation of this new public plan, which would exist alongside Medicare, Medicaid, and the other government programs that exist right now, so that those who don't have insurance right now would go into the marketplace and would make a choice. They could look at the options being offered by private insurers, and then they could look at what the government plan offers. That's a really, really important component for a lot of Democrats and for grassroots organizers who will undoubtedly play a very important role in this. There are those who favor a single-payer system who I think also see that as a mechanism to ultimately get there. That's also one of the reasons why the public plan is very controversial among insurers and some others who don't want to go the single-payer route.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen,
yes.
If I can just give a one-minute summary of what Obama at least proposed before the election. You know, as I mentioned, expanding Medicaid for the poor. Right now, a lot of poor people don't get coverage from our state program. Mandating that kids get insurance through so-called children's health insurance program, often called CHIP, and that would include more subsidies. So again, that's the public sector. Strengthening the Medicare program. Some discussion that, you know, older Americans who are retired but below 65 would come on board. And then, as Noam said, these private plans, somewhat like Massachusetts, or some say like the federal employees, that everybody, regardless of their health status, and Roger, this is obviously a huge issue. If you're sick, insurance companies don't want you, they have to take everybody, every American. And for that group that joins these publicly managed but private plans, and I don't think Mike would like that, but nonetheless, they would get subsidies from the government to make it affordable. So that in 1 or 2 minutes is at least
very good.
6 months ago what he wants to do.
Very good.
Well said.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Noam, I know you're on a time bind here this morning, deadline probably, so let me know when you have to go.
I think I have to drop off now, but thanks
okay.
so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your article, too. It got us rolling on this topic today. Thank you.
Take care.
We're continuing here. Professor Weiner
I'm
is
here.
With us for the whole hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. I mean, we hear this statement, but what you just said is fairly dramatic, Professor Weiner. If you're sick, health insurance companies don't want you. What kind of system is that? If you're sick, you need health insurance.
Well, the rest of the world sort of shakes their head at us.
Right.
But, you know, that's the system we've set up. I really, you know, the right up there as the evil doers on most, you know, cartoons are the health insurance executives. I have never met an evil health insurance executive. Part of the problem is, we structure these systems. So, they make money by keeping people away from health care. And so we need to restructure the system. Even the not-for-profits, like some of the Blue Cross systems, which started out as not-for-profits, some of them are no longer not-for-profit, you know, have changed their focus. And so that's something we need to do.
Yeah. Let's go to Kathy from Waupaca next. Hi, Kathy. Whoa, wait a second. We got to dump that line and get this line. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Yes, okay. I have a couple of points. My mother is 86 and she lives in Illinois. Twice this year she had to have a procedure for detached retina in one eye. The first time didn't take. Obviously, she is covered by Medicare, and I think her out-of-pocket was something like $200. Medicare already works. Like the doctor who called in before, I think a single-payer system based on the idea of Medicare is probably the best way to go. There's no way my mother could have paid for a procedure otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
She would be blind in that eye right now. The second point, my husband has really, really good insurance through his employer. Only problem is they have to tinker with it every single year to try to shave some money off of it. So often you can be going to a specialist and then find out the next year you go see that specialist, oops, he's not on the plan anymore. He's not a preferred provider, so now you got to shell out of pocket. So much for continuity of care there. So I would just like your comments on those. Thanks.
Well, those are a lot of good comments. First of all, I hope to some of your listeners who run businesses, small or middle-sized businesses, and are trying to do the right thing, provide health care, call up. It's not uncommon that those folks have to pay 15, 20, 30% more every year.
Mm.
And we've heard that probably the number one issue with GM and the automakers is the cost of health care. And so that's a huge issue. And we must be sensitive to these costs because, in fact, that's what Dashiell and others want to do is make health care affordable, which it is not. Back to the Medicare again, there's clearly a sentiment that Medicare is a lot better than some of the other aspects of health care we have, and it is. One problem, I'm sure there'll be plenty of your doctors, although they're probably not going to call right now during the day. They're not happy with Medicare. Medicare is ratcheting costs down. Medicare is trying to make decisions about what to cover and not cover. So they're headed for the cliff as well. And I actually sit on a panel on Medicare that does scientific review of what it should or shouldn't cover. And, we ain't seen nothing yet. Should Medicare cover a $10,000 drug that will keep someone going for another 2 or 3 months? At the same time, we don't cover, insulin for many tens of thousands of people in Wisconsin. These are the tough issues.
Well, who decides that? Who says yes or no?
Well, right now, Medicare is sort of a haphazard approach, and they're not allowed to look at money. So, in fact, Medicare is not really the wisest health care payer in the world. On the other hand, most people in America, all three of your listeners so far, prefer Medicare over the private sector, that is, the private insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So.
It's fairly popular. You don't hear too many people complain a lot about Medicare, do you?
No, it's headed for the cliff, and we're all subsidizing it. But that's not my problem or any person's problem who's actually on Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, so mm-hmm. I think that's really the challenge we all face in the public policy context.
Debbie from Madison, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually a caller that has both perspectives. I'm a self-employed person trying to find health insurance for myself, and then I'm also a licensed midwife in the state of Wisconsin who thinks that if we started using different models of care, and just as you mentioned, scientifically backed evidence showing more cost-effective care, that we could do a much, much better job. I mean, just for instance, if we could cut the C-section rate to half, which is what the World Health Organization currently promotes, we could save billions and billions of dollars. And yet we're stuck because we're fighting against major money and lobbyists in the medical association. Any thoughts?
Well, as you know, there's tons of controversy in midwifery, OBG, and frankly, there's tons of controversy in any clinical area, and so much of that has to do with finance. So, for example, the earlier caller talked about Norway. I do a lot of work in Scandinavia, and as you know, the midwives and OBGs have very good relations there. That's because they're all paid on salary or capitation, and they try to do the right thing and not worry about payment. And again, neither midwives or OBGs are evil, are all doing God's work, but we all have to make an income. So I think getting healthcare costs, getting finance all aligned with good health and prevention and the science is really what I think Dashiell is trying to do, but good luck to him.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Can we talk a little bit about major healthcare needing to be woven into the overall economic recovery plan? It seems to me as though this issue is so huge. Healthcare is so huge, and the fact that we have no money and we're bailing everybody out is so huge. How do you deal with that? How do you move forward?
Well, healthcare, depending how you count, the number one or number two component of our economy, and it's all intertwined.
Mm.
Our healthcare system is, we actually have the biggest public healthcare system in the world. We sometimes forget that, even though only 45% of Americans get their healthcare publicly. It's bigger than the British National Health Service and really all the European systems. But 55, well, aside from the 15% that don't have health care, but then the rest of us get private healthcare, and it's intertwined. It's always the number one issue in any factory's budget is actually healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very complicated, and I think maybe it'll take a crisis, as I think Noam discussed. Maybe it'll take a crisis to allow Washington to realize we have to act. I don't know. I think it's going to be difficult.
Yeah. Tom from Kenosha. Hi.
Hi. I worked in the healthcare industry for a while in the 90s, and I came away with a bad experience. And I came up with the principle that no one's healthcare should depend on a for-profit business. And I was wondering, could we make a big gain in the system by just passing a law that says anyone providing healthcare has to be a not-for-profit business?
Well, ironically, your neighbors there in Minnesota, to the best of my knowledge, even though they're the headquarters of the biggest for-profit healthcare HMO, United Healthcare, in fact, passed such a law, at least in the context of health insurance. But I've also worked with, as I said before, you know, the for-profit healthcare is not evil. They're trying to do a decent job, but you know, there are challenges. So maybe that's not the right way to do it. But I've worked with a lot of not-for-profit insurance companies, and they're faced with the same challenges. So I don't know that that's the answer, Tom. Hillary, first time around, and Bill Clinton really attempted to actually have what they called accountable health plans, which were provider-based, not-for-profit, take the lead, and you saw what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Make a follow-up?
Yes.
Sure, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I just think that there's a lot of slack in the system, and there's a lot of fat profits being made by the big health insurers for sure, and you could collapse that all down by having a not-for-profit framework where full disclosure of all accounting books were required.
I think those are good suggestions. It is true there's all kinds of profits on Wall Street. We won't go there. We see what a house of cards that is. The typical insurance company, though, does not take money, put it in its pocket, and then not give it to people who need health care. Although there's a little bit of that going on, it's only a few percentage. Where there's really fat in the system, I think, is sort of administrative waste and, you know, too much marketing. And as one of your callers indicated, in most of our cities in America, we have a system that is not efficient. You know, there may be 10 scanners on a city block, as there is in Baltimore where I work, where there might only need to be 5. But that's how we've designed the system. And that's really not the insurance company's fault. That's really our entire system's fault.
Right. How many, I don't know if somebody's done a study on this, if anybody has, you have, or you'd have a good answer. What percentage do you think of people in this country are happy with their health plans?
Surprisingly, most people.
Are
That's
they?
Why health reform is so difficult. You know, those that aren't insured or those that have recently lost it, they're not too happy. Everybody does not like the HMO. In fact, they're way up at the top of the list with tobacco executives and oil executives. But the fact of the matter is, you ask them, you know, do you want to change? Do you want government-run health care? They say no. And there are, you know, the Kaiser Family Foundation is a not-for-profit, not to be confused with Kaiser HMO. That's also not-for-profit. They have excellent KFF.org. They sponsor a survey very regularly. And so if people are interested, you know, they show every month how people view health care and, you know, do they want to change and don't they?
Thanks for the call. Here's a small business owner who sent us an email. Why do we have to make this so complicated? Why can't we expand the Medicare for everyone and pay for it by increasing the Medicare tax that we're already paying and supplementing it with funds already available with Medicaid and CHIP funds? I'm a small business owner and would not have to deal with insurance companies increasing their rates and reducing coverage. A company can then offer a supplemental coverage plan if they want to.
Again, we've heard that idea. It's a good idea. It doesn't seem to have, well, it has many positive aspects. I'll point out a negative in a moment. But it doesn't seem to have the traction, the support out there. Now, there is, I also think that in part, Obama is not going to put everything in place in year one. We all hope that he puts it in place by year 4 or year 8 if he's in for 2 terms. But many states are getting out in front. You know, Wisconsin's one of them. Maryland's one of them. Massachusetts, California. And so there may be opportunities for local reform, and I'd encourage your listeners to, you know, explore what's happening in Wisconsin. I also know there's a lot of excellent work going on at your university in Madison on health care reform issues. And so, you know, perhaps you could do something like that in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Peter is next from Elm Grove. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
I'm actually a physician, and I wanted to make a couple of points here. Everybody talks about how much our health care costs in the United States versus other countries and how low our life expectancy is compared to other countries who actually spend a lot less money. The reason this is because we have one of the most unhealthy cultures in the world. I mean, with the garbage people eat and their lack of exercise and, you know, their lack of access to preventative care, all of this leads to higher costs in the end. And so America is a very unhealthy culture. So as a physician, I have to tell you that basically with what we're working with, we're doing a pretty good job. We're keeping people alive as long as we can. Second of all, I think that sort of plays into the cost in sort of how unrealistic America is in terms of their beliefs about what they should be getting from healthcare. I see it time and time again where we have these 85 and 90-year-old patients who have severe dementia. They don't know what's going on. They're in a nursing home, and their family wants everything done for them. And they spend 12 to 15 days in the ICU at $10,000 a day for the room alone.
Mm-hmm.
And the family, after 12 days and $120,000 of room fees alone, decides to, you know, cut off care. You know, this massively inflates the amount of money we're spending on healthcare every year. And so my question is, should there be any sort of a cutoff in the national healthcare systems saying something like, I'm sorry, but after age 85 or 87, mm-hmm. we're just not going to pay for intensive care unit care. After that point, you can have preventative health and you can have hospice care, but we're just not going to pay $10,000 a day for unrealistic care.
Hmm.
Well, I think Peter, as a healthcare expert himself, identified two of the critical issues, and shall I say not easy issues, as I'm sure as he is, and any listener can realize. You know, first, the prevention. We're not a very prevention and living healthy. That's absolutely essential. You know, wellness, public health is really, in many ways, more important than our medical care system. And we must make that front and center, and that's one of the weaknesses of the Medicare program, for example, as compared to some of the forward-thinking HMOs in managed care. They don't think about population. They don't think about prevention. And on the issue of end of life, absolutely, and that's really tough. You know, we need to learn how to die well in America. We're all going to die. And I think that issues of hospice and, you know, when do we give someone a humane, non-expensive death. Again, that's far bigger than I can handle just on a phone call. But we must have more, you know, ethical discussions. And, you know, people, of course, are welcome to pay for whatever they want. But in that case, you know, that $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 death in an ICU, we're all paying for that. And so we all need to discuss that.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it interesting that you respond, at least I respond to what Peter said in a couple ways. One is, of course, we shouldn't pay that kind of money. And the other thing is, we don't talk about dying in this country, as you just said. We need to have a full-fledged, open discussion about all of this, because it almost, you're for it. And then at the same time, you think, wait a second, I don't know if I could do that as a family member, just let somebody not get treatment, because we live in this sophisticated culture with all this treatment. But of course it makes sense not to pay for that.
And I might add, in most other countries, not that it's perfect, they do a better job. But you know, critics will say, hey, you know, they're rationing, and they're saying that this 90-year-old can't get that heart bypass. Well, you know, maybe that's the ethical thing to do.
Right. I don't know. We're going to welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Jonathan Weiner. He's director of the PhD program in Health Services Research and Policy, deputy director of Health Services Research and Development Center, and a faculty member in the Division of Health Sciences. And that's for the awarding of academic degrees at Johns Hopkins University. His interests, the field of healthcare policy and health services research and evaluation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. One line is open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, we'll talk with the author of Websterisms, a collection of words and definitions set forth by the founding father of American English. Our guest said he was intrigued by how much Webster revealed his religious beliefs, his personality, and the times in which he lived via the word definitions that he wrote. He started in January of 1825, and it took him a long, long time, something like 25 years, to write the first American dictionary. It's a fascinating story, and you will hear it the second hour of our program. We go back to phone calls for Professor Jonathan Weiner, and our next call is Midge from Madison. Hi, Midge.
Hi. I think that this has been interesting because almost everybody that called in, even the professional doctors, have said that single payer and using health care are their main one. And the only and even Obama says that single payer is the best. The only thing anybody says is, but it's not politically feasible. Actually, this year is our time to make it politically feasible. We are really getting a coalescing, not just on the radio now, but over 93 of the current members of Congress have signed on to John Conyers' bill, H.R. 676. And I think at least five of the new Congress people are supportive of that. That's basically expanding Medicare, and you can get it's about 16% is what our whole medical expenses are spent on medicine in the country, mostly private, but Medicare and everything. If we had that in a Medicare public single-payer system, we could take care of everybody, the underinsured and the uninsured. And also the PNHP, which is an organization of more than 15,000 physicians, has come out also for H.R. 676. Now, when they say it's not politically possible, I don't know what they mean by politically possible in this country. I thought it was the public's desire that the Congress is supposed to support. And there's no question that the majority of people who have studied this at all believe that this is they're coalescing and converging on this one bill, and it's up to everybody that's listening, everybody that deals with this question, to contact everybody in Congress so that the president and the Congress will not say that it's not politically feasible. They'll say they will realize that it's not politically acceptable for them to deny health care when almost every other advanced nation in the world already provides it for their students. We have the ability. The Medicare system is all set up. You don't have to set up a new system. You just expand it to cover everybody, and you take the money that individuals have been paying for their health insurance. And another thing that pressures very much for this now is the fact that our economy is in such trouble. If we could take the load of paying for health insurance off of our, let's say, our car companies compared to car companies in other countries where the health care is taken care of by the government, we would greatly help the economy.
All right. Midge, thank you so much for your call. Professor Weiner.
Well, my only comment is, Midge, go for it. Obviously, if it's based on your last listeners, you've got a quorum. I'm not sure that's the case out in the rest of the world. But, again, that's not for me to say. But certainly Obama has made the decision, rightly or wrongly, that he'd rather get something good in place rather than wait for something perfect that he can't get in place. But again, I'm just commenting on his view.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Midge, so much for your call. Dave from, it's Ed from Wausau is next. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I've worked in healthcare all my life. By accident, I went into the Army and I became a medical specialist, and an X-ray tech. When I came out, job market was not too good. And just recently entered Medicare. When I was a department head at a hospital, I would be talking with Medicare auditors and things like that. Essentially, I was getting reimbursed at 60 cents on the dollar, a dollar of actual cost. Now that I'm on Medicare, I just got back from spending about 3.5 hours, and on the second occasion, 2 hours on the same problem at a major educational institution. The bill was like $17,000. The reimbursement to the institution and the physicians, the bottom line reimbursement was 3.63% of the total bill. In other words, for a $17,000 bill, The institution and the physicians got reimbursed $388.
Yeah, people aren't, as you know, the people that run hospitals are not too happy with Medicare, nor are the doctors. On the other hand, although there are certainly pockets of economic problems, our doctors and hospitals in America, even on Medicare, are really fairly financially sound. So it's a bit of a game, but Ed is exactly right and exactly accurate. It's quite a mess out there, and most doctors and hospitals would probably roll their eyes a bit at your listeners wanting to expand Medicare for everyone. But on the other hand, they're not happy with the private insurance companies either, so pick your, you know.
You keep reading about doctors who will not take Medicaid or Medicare patients. Is that a growing problem, or is it overstated?
It is a problem. You know, in part because they're feeling like they're getting 50 cents on the dollar or 40 cents on the dollar. And we have, I believe, enough doctors in America. Some don't believe that, but we definitely don't have enough doctors in the right place doing the right thing. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And so in many places, among many of your listeners, it's not easy to get a specialist or certainly a primary care doctor, particularly, who's willing to take Medicare or Medicaid.
Thanks, Ed, so much for your call. Brett is next from Watertown. Hi, Brett.
Actually, it's Fred, and I just passed
through
Manamahawk, where there's another huge, redundant corporate medical structure. But my point really was that most of your guests today have just been excellent, and although I appreciate the professor's comments, it's apparent that an awful lot of people who come from within the system understand the issues more than the people who are not in the system. We need to take the profit out of healthcare. That's the issue. The insurance companies are enormously profitable companies. All of that money is not going towards healthcare. The healthcare pie is so terribly divided. I'll be interested to see whether President Obama, who I voted for, will be able to do anything about all those egalitarian platitudes that he spouted when he's under the pressure of the lobbyists from the insurance companies. So we need to break up the corporate organized healthcare providers who are evil, regardless of what your guts thinks, and the insurance companies, who are people, regardless of what your guest believes, because they are in this business for profit. And if you're a physician and you're whining about the fact that you can no longer make $300,000 or $400,000 a year, you know, I'm not too empathetic with that cry. I don't make $300,000 a year. So I think that all of your guests, and Midge in particular, ought to lead the group. She really encapsulated things very nicely. But we need to take the profit out of healthcare.
Okay, Brett, thank you so much. How would the system change if we did take it? It seems to me as though it would change quite a bit if we took the profit out of the whole system. What would appear, what would disappear, Professor Weiner?
Well, certainly we'd have some savings off the top. But again, I repeat, there certainly is profit in the system. The biggest problem has to do really more design and focus. So right now, if you're sick, you know, insurance companies don't want you. So that, to me, that's a huge problem, obviously. Their actual profit off the top may just be a few percentage, but keeping people out of the system that need the system. A bigger problem are the hospitals of America, mine included, and everyone among your listeners. Their goal are to keep those beds filled, to offer expensive procedures. Their goal should be prevention, wellness. So it really is far bigger than just the HMOs and their profit. And I repeat, the not-for-profit health plans, you know, often don't do a lot better than the for-profit. And to answer your question, I'll let your listeners decide. Sometimes government and not-for-profit do a great job. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes companies, entrepreneurs, for-profit do a great job. Sometimes they don't. So we've got to make this meet the proper objectives, and then, you know, have a collective discussion like we're having right now.
Yeah.
What the role should be.
What about doctors? Is the average salary $300,000? I've heard that primary care doctors don't make that much.
It ranges from $1 million to $50,000. It's correct. The average primary care doctor may, quote, only, you know, make $120,000, $150,000. In some of your rural areas, they might not be able to even make $50,000. And there's plenty of specialists that, as Fred said, that are unhappy with their $300,000. So take your pick. It's everywhere in between. And our doctors are the best paid in the world. So But that's the standard that we've set, and, you know, I guess we might need to continue.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us. It's going to be interesting to see if the new administration could deal with substantive changes in this system and break the 50-year deadlock of doing anything significant, isn't
sure,
it?
Thanks for inviting me, and I think we all have consensus. Mitch should go be the deputy to Daschle. So there you go.
Thank you for the call, or for the
take
time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, amid you, we're quite a hit here today. Thanks to Professor Jonathan Weiner for being with us the full hour of the program. He is director of the PhD program in Health Services Research and Policy and a professor in the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. And we thank Noam Levy for being with us as well. Noam, a reporter with the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau, who wrote a lengthy piece this week on Tom Daschle and really got us thinking about the issue and how Tom Daschle, who will head Health and Human Services and also this new White House Office on Health Reform, will guide health care reform in this country, what his goals are, what Obama's goals are, what the American people's goals are, and whether or not we can move this conversation forward. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your calls, everybody. They were wonderful, as always. News ahead, and we'll return on the Ideas Network.